We start with chapter 26, verse 7, and it reads, "The way of the righteous is level. O just one, you make smooth the path of the righteous. In the path of your judgments, Yahweh, we wait for you. Your name and your renown are the soul's desire." Your name, Yahweh, obviously, and your renown, other people to know about this, to want to know, is what the people want. They want the world to know about Yahweh, this at its best. "My soul," personally now, it's like a psalm, isn't it? "My soul yearns for you in the night." Soul, nephesh in Hebrew, means — they don't have the Greek idea of body and soul, which is a dangerous dichotomy, really. They were much more simple. What you see is what you've got. What you can touch is what you — what, it's all pretty — they're not an abstract language, Hebrew. So your soul is really your being, but under a certain aspect — it's all of you, but it's under the aspect of longing, desiring. It's you, just you, longing and desiring is your soul. So it includes your body, of course, the physical and the emotional. And the spirit is important, because your spirit is — that stands outside all the other words they've got. And by spirit they mean breath, which is never ours. God breathed into Adam, into human being, the breath of life. So, but you see, as soon as you breathe it in, you can't hold it. You have to give it back. And then it's given to you again, and then you give it back. So it's the divine breath, God's breath, in you. So when my spirit earnestly seeks you, it means that part of me that's directly connected with you, God, and that comes from you, and I have to give it back to you. And eventually I give it back entirely, like Jesus, "Into your hands I commend my spirit," and then death. So it's given back to God. But normally then God keeps giving it back to us till we die. So that's the two ideas of soul. Translated soul, or I, really, is just as good. "I yearn for you in the night" would be a perfect translation, as long as you know the "I" there has this nuance of the longing. "For when your judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world learn righteousness." When your judgments — in other words, when the king judges according to your will, and the king is in charge of justice as well as law and order, and when people do this, well, the world is — it'll learn how to live rightly, to be righteous, wise as to what is right. So that's wise there, really. Corrupted. Right, wise. "If favour is shown to the wicked, they don't learn righteousness." So be tough on them. Punish them, you know, really, to get them straight, because they're going to take advantage of it if they get back. "In the land of uprightness, they deal perversely. They don't see the majesty of God." Verse 11, "Yahweh, your hand is lifted up." Lifted up with a sword, power. Your arm really is better than hand there, because the word used that's translated hand regularly in the Bible means from your fingertips to your elbow. That part of it. So it's really the arm with the sword. "Your arm is lifted up, but they don't see it. Let them see your zeal for your people," for us. "Come and defend us. And let them be ashamed." A very important little line here. "Let the fire for your adversaries consume them." They're our adversaries. Someone asked about the Moabites and the Edomites. In this case, it's the Assyrians, or depends on when you're reading this, who it happens to be. well, they're our enemies, and there's an assumption all the way through the Bible that we're God's chosen people, so our enemies are God's enemies. That's ergo, that's logic. So therefore, God wants us to get rid of them, the Canaanites, the Philistines, the Moabites, the Edomites, every ite around the place, because they're God's enemies, obviously, because they're our enemies, and we're precious to God. Dreadfully dangerous way of looking at life, surely. And when you look at Jesus, it should just stop. But our conversion to Jesus is pretty skin deep. So we look at Europe in the 1900s, eh? And look at the world. So, but they're your enemies. Let it Yahweh, you will ordain peace for us, for indeed all that we have done, you have done for us. It's lovely. Yahweh, our God, other lords besides you have ruled over us. And there are the Assyrians, the Babylonians, by the time this is put in here, the Greeks, it's the long-stop Persians. But we acknowledge your name alone. The dead do not live. Shades do not rise. I'll spend some time on this with you this morning. The basic assumption of the Old Testament is that life ends with death. They had that in common with the Assyrians, with that part of the world, the Near East. One great nation that you know about had a totally different view, and that is Egypt. And throughout the Bible, all the way through, there are laws constantly about not worshipping ancestors and not calling on the shades, necromancy, not calling on the dead. And why are they there all the time? You don't keep enacting laws unless people are disobeying them. If no one's doing it, you don't bother. So obviously, right through the history of Israel, there was this perhaps natural thing of... So the strong stand, again, is related to that, trying to crush out calling on the dead and the shades and all that kind of superstitious behaviour that was going on. So that's the norm in their thing. I'll have to read on that. The dead do not live. Shades do not rise. Shades means... The ghostly things that are down there. They're there, but they're not really alive. They're just shades. Because you have punished and destroyed them and wiped out all memory of them. But you have increased the nation, Yahweh. That's us. More and more. Kids are growing. Population's growing. You've increased the nation. You are glorified. You've enlarged the borders of the land. Is he referring back to David in the legend of David? Whatever David actually did is not historically, we can't be certain. Josiah, we have historical information about that. He tried to re-establish what was said to be the kingdom of David back 400 years earlier. And he didn't succeed, but he did something in that line. Yahweh, in distress they sought you. They poured out a prayer when you were when your chastising was on them. Like a woman with child who writhes and cries out in her pangs when she's near her time, so were we because of you, Yahweh. And what a powerful line this is of self-awareness. We were with child. We writhed. But we gave birth only to wind. It was a pseudo pregnancy. You know, we had all the, we should have been, but we weren't. It was just all hot air, really. So it's a humble admission of sin and failure and not picking up what was supposed to be happening. We have won no victories on earth, and no one is born to inhabit the world. So this is written obviously at a time of depression and exile and all the rest of it, so they're declining. This is the most interesting line. Your dead He's talked about the dead on the last page, but your dead shall live. Their corpses shall rise. A couple of things that won't help you a lot, but the Hebrew is quite disturbed here. That's one little thing to tell you. Because actually the Hebrew says, my corpse shall rise. That doesn't, not that significant, but there's alterations in the text, which is a problematic thing. Just as that famous one of Job is, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the end he will, I will see him. That's a real guess of a translation of a very disturbed Hebrew text. So we're dealing here with growth in and alteration of perception, which I'm now going to spend some time with you, because the fact that corpses is used there, you're dead, is an indication of a belief in the resurrection, doesn't it? The personal resurrection of the body. So when that came in, we'll talk about, was clear in the 2nd century BC. So we've got the text being altered, updated, re-looked at quite late. What was actually in the original, we can only guess at. So somehow or other, the original, you'd expect the original to be kind of metaphorical. They live in their ancestors, in their descendants, rather. They live because they are the children, you know, live in your children's children, and so it'll happen. But later, and I'm going to now do that with you, so I won't delay on here, gradually there were dreams about this, and then at the time of the Maccabean revolt, the awareness of the resurrection of the body, of the person, came into the consciousness of the Jewish world. O dwellers in the dust, awake, sing for joy, for your dew is a radiant dew. The ground, you're dead, but where the ground is, it's moist, and new life is coming and bursting forth from the ground. The earth will give birth to those long dead. Read it metaphorically, read it poetically, read it actually. Let's start on that little journey, and then I'll see how you're going. This is a fairly brief, but I hope accurate, understanding of the resurrection of the dead in Judaism. I'll start by reminding you of the New Testament. Do you recall Paul being caught in the temple area, and he started a fight between the Sadducees and the Pharisees because he said, I believe in the resurrection of the dead. And the Pharisees said, yeah, he's right on that. Sadducees says, no, he's not right. And he kept them squabbling. In the meantime, the Romans got him and got him out. So a divide and conquer kind of thing. So at the time of Jesus, the Pharisees were committed to the idea of life after death and the resurrection of the human being, however one imagines it. The Sadducees were the traditionalists, because this was a newfangled idea, which they rejected. And we know from the New Testament that Sadducees did not believe in angels, didn't believe, because the Old Testament didn't either. It was only late in the Greek period that those ideas of angels and devils came in. And it was only then that the idea of the resurrection of the body came in, or the person, perhaps better put. So you've got a dispute at Jesus' time. You remember the Sadducees who didn't believe in it, made fun with Jesus and talked about a bloke who had all these wives, and what did the wife have? The wife had them, and the husbands were all dying one after the other. You'd think they got the message, but anyhow, the seventh bloke, and they said, well, who's going to be her husband in heaven? And Jesus said, you are wrong, because you understand neither the scripture nor the power of God. And he says, God is a God of the living, not the dead. So Jesus' belief in the life beyond death was absolutely complete, and his resurrection is critical to us as Christians. So with that in mind, let's go back and look at the development. The oldest traditional idea, which the Sadducees still held at the time of Jesus, was that the dead are lifeless shades, ghostly things, down there, because you put them in the grave, and underneath the earth somewhere there's this place where the shades wander around. Some texts. Psalm 88, my soul is full of troubles, my life draws near to Sheol, that's Hades. I'm counted among those who go down to the pit. I'm like those who have no help, like those forsaken among the dead. like the slain that lie in the grave, like those you remember no more, for they are cut off from your hand. Psalm 115, the dead do not praise the Lord, nor do any that go down into silence. Isaiah 38, Sheol cannot thank you, death cannot praise you, those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your faithfulness. So keep me alive so that I can keep praising you. And it's a win-win situation. I'm really ill, but if I stay alive, I'll be able to praise you, and that'll be good for you and good for me. So, because when I die, it's going to be no good to you and no good to me. So it's kind of bribing God to keep me alive, and that's fair enough. Sirach, this is the 2nd century BC, early probably, Sirach. Who will sing praises to the Most High in Hades? From the dead, as from those who do not exist, thanksgiving has ceased. So that's the standard, and you find it all over the Bible. Standard understanding. However, obviously there's also this longing in the human heart, which we understand. Here's some expressions of longing. Timing them's impossible. They could come from anywhere. Psalm 16, my heart is glad, my soul rejoices, my body also rests secure. For you do not give me up to Sheol. You do not let your faithful one see the pit. You show me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. In your right hand are pleasures evermore. Now that's not a belief in the resurrection, but it's a longing for life to continue praising God. And it's how far you take that. Psalm 49, God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Doesn't mean I'm going to die and then rise, but God is going to rescue me from the pit. See? Stop me dying, in other words. That's what it's basically saying. But it's in there is a longing to be with God forever, whatever. He will receive me. Psalm 73, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. Afterwards, you will receive me with honor. Whom have I in heaven but you? There's nothing on earth that I desire other than you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. I'm not presenting those as in any sense explicitly believing in the resurrection. Just presenting them as while people did not believe in the resurrection, there is this longing to be with God, which is timeless, I suppose, spaceless, not limited. Now, there is an emerging sense of rising from the dead. You might recall that statement from Ezekiel about the dry bones. Quite beautiful scene. Now, that's not resurrection from the dead. It's the army that's been... It's written in the exile, so they're in the dust, but out of it is going to rise. The nation is going to rise. So the nation is going to continue, not the individuals. But there is a longing in there that I think you can read. Then, as I will do later, here's our text now, this apocalyptic text we've just read. The dead do not live, shades do not rise. You have punished and destroyed them. You've wiped out the memory of them all. But your dead shall live. Their corpses shall rise. This is the most explicit statement we've found yet. O dwellers in the dust, arise, awake, sing for joy, for your dew is a radiant dew, and the earth will give birth to those long dead. I think one can only assume that that later statement, developing an earlier statement, belongs to the later period, the apocalyptic period. That's, I suppose, an assumption, but a good working one. Because something happened in the early part of the 2nd century BC, and I'll just remind you of it. They had this fixed idea that if you die young, that God's punishing you for sin, either yours or your parents'. they had the idea that a long life was obviously a blessing from God for goodness. That's a simple view. They had the idea that death was the end. Then came in this, by the way, the Greek idea of the immortality of the soul is sneaking in, like they're being influenced by Greece, and because it's the Greek period. So obviously philosophically their thoughts are getting into a wider perspective somewhere. But particularly at the time of the Syrian persecutions that they're detailed in the books of Maccabees, this phenomenal thing happened. Young people holding on to their faith were murdered, martyred. And it just kind of, they had to forget their theology and look at the facts. They had to start thinking that this can't be a punishment from God. I mean, these are young people who are so strong in their faith. They're holding on to the Torah, they're believing in God, and they're willing to give up their life for God. Do you get me? So that can't be a punishment. So there must be something beyond death if God is just. There must be something. So emerging into their consciousness of many of them, not the old traditionalists, not the clergy of the day, but the people who are in touch with their life experiences. And so we have here in the book of Daniel, which is written at this time, chapter 12, and in the second book of Maccabees, chapter 7, which is about the mother of the Maccabees. She had seven, I think, boys, and encouraged them all not to give up on their faith, and they were all murdered in front of her eyes, and it's a tragic story. But here's the bit from Daniel. At that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who's found written in the book of life. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. The meaning of the many I don't really understand, but it's obviously a dawning of an idea that those to be punished will be punished, those to be praised will be praised, and it's not a small group. And here you have an explicit statement that there is life beyond death, though they, of course, didn't try to imagine it. And I'm suggesting to you, only as a, that passage from Isaiah belongs to the same genre, the same period. And to conclude this little... There were extraordinary stories in the legends of the Old Testament, this is the list of them, there's no more than this. There's a story about Enoch, back in the book of Genesis, chapter 5. Enoch walked with God, then he was no more because God took him. Don't ask me to get into the mind of the author of that, but somehow or other, Enoch, who's one of the descendants of Adam, is caught up in heaven somewhere. He didn't die. He walked with God, and then he was no more. God took him. This is easier to imagine. Elijah, because this became part of their psyche too. You remember the prophet Elijah? He's ascended in a whirlwind into heaven on a fiery chariot too. So God, he's up there with God, and they think that one day he'll come back, because he's actually never died. He's with God. Hasn't physically died and then gone to God. He's actually been taken up, assumed into God, and one day he's going to come back. And then they thought John the Baptist might be him. You remember that? And they thought, gee, who do the people say that I am? Some say you're Elijah. Some say you're one of the... So this was the common people were expecting Elijah to come back and introduce the Messiah. That's what they all thought. So... And when they asked Jesus, he said, Elijah has come back. And he points to John the Baptist. And he's the Elijah you're looking for. Have a look at him, listen to him, etc. So there, that's Elijah. And in the Book of Wisdom, written in the Greek Jewish world in Alexandria, about contemporary with the birth of Jesus, it looks like it's the very last years of of BC, or the very early years of AD. It's the most recent of the books of the Old Testament in Greek. There were some who pleased God and were loved by him, while living among sinners were assumed, taken up. So They're those extraordinary stories, and I really have nothing to add to that, so I'll just